Greetings to our listeners. My name is Almir Lima Nascimento. I am the director of the Institute of Research on International Relations at the Alexandre de Guzmán Foundation. And it's my honor to welcome you to another episode of our podcast series, Diplomacy 21. This initiative counts in a series of podcasts with diplomats, specialists, and academics from Brazil and from abroad, which aims to foster discussions and share knowledge on pertinent issues surrounding the past, the present, and the future of international relations and diplomacy. Today, we are immensely privileged to have with us Sciences Po professor Christian Lequesne, a distinguished scholar and a profound analyst of France's foreign policy, an analyst also of European politics and international affairs. Professor Lequesne holds a doctorate in political science from Sciences Po, Paris, and has had an illustrious academic journey, which includes serving as the director of Sciences Po Center for International Studies, CERI, and the LSE European Institute. He has also been a visiting professor at various prestigious institutions worldwide, shedding light on the European Union's external actions and the evolving dynamics of diplomacy. It's a great pleasure to have you with us, Professor, and I would like to pass you the floor for your initial remarks, and we could carry on the delightful conversation on subjects that we have been studying here at Rio Branco, at FUNAG, and other parts of the diplomatic activity. Thank you very much once again.
Thank you very much for this very warm and kind introduction. It's a real pleasure to exchange with you today. And first of all, we have to acknowledge the technology, because you are in Brasilia. I am somewhere near Paris, and we are able to discuss and register or have this podcast. So I just would like to say that 20 years ago, it would have been very difficult to have such an exchange. So technology has positive consequences for exchanges if you know how to use them, right? Because of course, as all tools, there are also risks, and we have to be cautious of the way we use it. But it's a great pleasure, because I try to make research work on diplomacies, which include also Brazil, and I know the how prestigious is the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Brazil, with a very old historical tradition. So it's a pleasure, really, to have this exchange with a think tank in Brasilia, run, chaired by a Brazilian diplomat like you, and I'm totally prepared now to answer all your questions.
Thank you very much, Professor. When I told my colleagues here that we were going to have a conversation, they got very interested in the topics. So I would like to come to the first of my set of questions. And the first question would be to listen to you about the following. In your opinion, how does adjusting to different cultures and political systems, and at the same time knowing your own country's culture, influence diplomats' performance in international negotiations?
Well, this is a kind of definition of what a diplomat has to do. A diplomat has to deal with other culture and try to understand them, but he has also to explain his own political system, but not only political system, societies to the others. And the diplomat is the person who is exactly in the middle of this exchange. To a certain extent, in theory of diplomacy, some define, because of that, the diplomat as a stranger, because the diplomat is the man who is in between, you know, his own environment, which is the national environment, and the outside environment. And what we have to do as a diplomat is to mediate and make sure that the partner understand the position of your state, but make sure also that your state, your capital, especially when you're posted, understand what is the position of the partner. And it's a double face work, right? You diplomat is a sort of Janus, this is what makes the job fascinating. Of course, to understand the others, you need to invest in a certain number of skills, language, study of the culture, etc. But you don't have to forget also what's going on at home. And I had this conversation yesterday with a French diplomat who told me, you know, it's very important that our young diplomat in France also knows what are the development of the French society, because sometimes when you are abroad for 10, 15 years, of course you read the newspapers, you read the cables, etc., but you also lose a bit, right, the relation with the with the home country. And this is why I think in the training of a diplomat, it's also important to have some reflection about what is going on at home. So for a Brazilian diplomat, also understanding very well the evolution of Brazil.
Mm-hmm. And I believe also that besides knowing very well the present culture, the present situation of a country, the diplomat need also to adjust to the different cultures and political systems, because he will be abroad. He will be a French diplomat, a Brazilian diplomat, an Italian diplomat, but when he's abroad, he also should demonstrate some sensibility to the environment that he is exposed. If you could elaborate a little more on this, please.
Of course, the codes, the cultural codes are not exactly the same everywhere in the world. The political regimes are not the same. The sense of hierarchy inside a government, formality or informality, are not the same. And then you have very identitarian things, like a certain number of countries of the world, a man doesn't shake the hand of a woman, etc. And this is what the diplomat has to learn. And I don't know, in fact, if this is something that you completely learn in books. Of course, if you have a good culture education before you go to the job, it helps. But I suspect that many of the reflex to understand and to behave correctly with other cultures come from practice. And this is something that you experience on the field.
Mm-hmm. That leads me to another question that is about education and training in diplomacy. We were talking about the certain cultural sensibility. So in your opinion, what is the role of education on ongoing training in preparing modern diplomats comparing to past traditional career development methods in the diplomatic service? In your opinion, what change, what a modern diplomat should have?
Well, I think several things have changed. Of course, it's still important to have an historical background, to have a language background, but it was also the case in the past. Now, what has changed, I think, is that a diplomat is a woman or a man who is not going to address only to other diplomats or to representatives of states, but to societies. And you have to understand, first of all, what is the social structure of a country beyond the state. It's not enough just to understand what is the organigram of a government today. You have to understand also what about the non-state actors? What about the autonomy of the business? What about the sensitivities of the youth, etc., etc.? Because you will have to address those people. Diplomacy now is less and less secret diplomacy. It doesn't, or status diplomacy. It does not mean that it has totally disappeared, but a great part of the job now is public diplomacy, and public diplomacy means that you have to understand the society and not only the state system. This is the first big change, I guess. The second big change is, of course, the way you communicate. And this is an enormous challenge for diplomacy today. 90% of the world communication goes through social media, and of course diplomacy has to adapt to that, right? So as a diplomat, you have to know how to use all those tools, Twitter, Instagram, have your blog, etc., etc. But you need also to know that on social media, you become a target as a diplomat, target of disinformation, of fake news, etc. So you have to know that, and you have to find the ways to go against. And I think this is now something taken into consideration by most of the communication departments of ministries of foreign affairs. Trying to be cautious about fake news and immediately react if those fake news arrive. And you have also to be cautious about the fact that social media is a very short form of communication. You have a limited number of signs. For instance, you take Twitter, and sometimes in diplomacy, you need to be very precise, right? So there is a sort of structural contradiction between the instantaneity of those tools and some requirement of diplomacy. It's a big challenge, but I think in terms of training, When I'm talking with young diplomats, not only in my country, but in other countries as well, when I ask them, what's the big challenge for you? And they say, we would like to know how to communicate with the modern tools, right? And not do mistakes. And um, And of course, this is not anymore just the press conferences where you have the correspondent of the different newspapers. This time is a bit finished, right? It's we are in another period, in another world, and ministries of foreign affairs have to adapt to this digital diplomacy.
When you talk about this digital diplomacy, I believe there's another challenge. That is the fact that everything today happens in what we call real time, in an instantaneous manner. Diplomacy has to react most of the time. At the moment, we don't have the time ancient diplomats had to think, to reflect, to prepare their documents. Something happens right now. In the next second, it's everywhere in the social media. How do you see this challenge of the real-time challenge we have today?
Well, you're absolutely right. And we can add that diplomats are also depending from politicians, because ministers and people who are around the ministers, usually they come from politics, and they want those people to react very, very quickly, right? It's very frequent in the entourage of a minister of foreign affairs that you have some people, specialists of communications, and it's a typical clash, you know, it's a classic clash between the way those people react very quickly and what the diplomats want to say or want to make, because in diplomacy, as you said, you need more time. So it's I think the role of the diplomat is to say to those who are in charge of this very instantaneous communication, well, you know, okay, try to react now, but it doesn't mean that it is the end of the story. I would like to remind you what happened in the past. It's very important also that somebody is there to be the institutional memory of foreign policy. And now we have communicated, but we still have to work on the issue, because this is not the end of the story, right? And yes, it's a typical structural contradiction between the work of the diplomat, which requires time, and the work of the communication person or officer, who has to react very, very quickly.
In 2017, you wrote a book, Ethnographie du Quai d'Orsay. It was a book where you explain a little bit about the French diplomatic culture. From 2017 up to today, there were changes in your opinions, or do you believe that we have more or less the same framework that we had before, in taking into account the culture, the necessity to communicate well, the necessity to understand other cultures? Because what happens today is that even from one year to another, the world can completely change. Huh? And how do you see that? You that wrote that very interesting book, I had the opportunity to read.
Well, no, things have changed, and they are changing every day, as you were saying. Probably what we just mentioned, communication, has become much more a pressure now than it was 10 years ago. But for a French diplomat, what has also changed is the international system, right? In 2017, when I wrote those books, would be misleading to say that the world was very West-centric. but because it was already not Western critic anymore. But the world has become today less and less West-centric. And this is something that you have to take into consideration in your practice when you are a diplomat from a Western country, especially because the rules which have been set up for regulating the international relations after the Second World War, they were set up by the Western powers, right? And now it's more and more contested. You have clearly the rise of China with competition with the United States. Those things, of course, now have to be taken into consideration. For a French diplomat, just understanding what's going on in Europe, in the United States, in OECD, and in Brazil, because I will put Brazil in the West, even if I know that there's always a debate about what to put Brazil, but let's say I would put Brazil in the West. Well, it's not enough. Now you have really to invest in what is going on in Asia, what is going on in the Middle East societies. And when I say Asia, it's not just China. It's also understanding Vietnam, understanding Korea, etc. So it's a world which is much more demanding for the practice of a diplomat.
Mm-hmm. And speaking from now on, I would like to also ask you a question about more concerning to future of diplomatic and consular relations. In your opinion, how can diplomatic and consular relations evolve in the future in an increasingly globalized world?
Well, I think the answer to that is that diplomacy will have to take into consideration more and more non-state actors. And even doing some form of partnership with non-state actors. Consular affairs is a very interesting topic. Because if you take consular affair in the traditional sense of the term, as it is defined in the Vienna Convention of 1963, what does it consist in? It consists mostly in protecting your nationals. Okay, and I think now what we see with the mobility of nationals abroad, we have more and more people living abroad. If I take my own country, France, we have probably 2.5 million citizens living abroad. If you take the city of London, for instance, UK, the number of French citizens there is 300,000, right? So it's a huge community. And you have the equivalent in New York, you have the equivalent in Montreal, etc. And if you take Brazil, you will find also this kind of figures, especially in the United States, New York, Miami, etc., etc. So now I think we have not to consider that consuls have just to protect and to make documents. They have also to keep the link with the diaspora, and they have to use the diaspora to make influence, right? This is typically what I call a new form of partnership with non-state actors, and some countries do that very well. If you take India, for instance, for a very long time, the Indian Foreign Service did not really take care of the Indians abroad. Now it's completely finished. when you have huge communities like the Indians in the United States, very educated people, able to invest in India, to transfer know-how, etc. Well, if you are a council of India somewhere in Chicago or in San Francisco, you have to take care of those people, make sure that you have a link. So my view about the future is that we will have, for instance, less and less consular diplomacy and more diaspora diplomacy. Right? And this is typically an evolution of the work, which will probably rehabilitate also the job of the consuls, because in many foreign service, consuls were for too long time considered a bit as not, you know, the heart of the job abroad compared to ambassadors, etc. And I think it's less and less the case. Well, even in the past, it was not the case, but it was like this. It was considered like this in the minds, especially of the different administrations of foreign affairs.
I believe you are absolutely right when you think about the technologies to concerning the possibility, the ICT. Information and communication technologies. I remember that when my first post abroad was in a consulate in Europe, in France, and I remember very well that at that time, when you had the Brazilian community living in France, they had an administrative life in France. Today, with this new information and communication technology, they are also part of the administrative life in Brazil, because everything can be done in a very quick and easy way through internet. So consular services, not only in Brazil, but in many other countries, are mostly demanded by persons that a few years ago wouldn't go to a consular session to solve a certain problem of a lack of a document, a lack of a registration, or things like this. So it's changed completely. We are linked as we were never before. And that, in my opinion, changed the way consular activities evolve. I don't know if I'm not mistaken, but you are writing a book about this kind of relation between government and the diasporas. Am I correct?
Absolutely. This is the next book I'm going to publish in March 2024. It will be first published in French and then in English in the United States. The focus of the book is French diaspora diplomacy and precisely see the relations between the diplomat and especially the frontline diplomat posted abroad and French community living abroad. And in the case of France, it's very interesting because there is a very old tradition of protecting the people, very generous to a certain extent, also in terms of giving scholarships for the French citizens who send the kids to the French lycée, having some form of social assistance, etc. But now we see that the paradigm is also moving towards new question, how to use the French abroad, and especially those who have success stories, and there's quite a lot of expatriates with success story, to develop influence, right? And this is the challenge now for general consuls also, is to make sure that they have good relations with people who could help diffusing the influence of the country in the world.
Mm-hmm. And thank you very much. Another topic I would like to raise here is about the analytical training in diplomacy. We were talking about consular activities. Now I move back to diplomacy. In your opinion, how can a diplomat's analytical training shape how they interpret information and analyze events? And to what extent can this interpretation be subjective due to their background?
Well, you know, when you write a report, there is always subjectivity. In general, when you write something, there is subjectivity because what you are reporting is about your perception and your representation. It's here that it's important that you have reflected before about the environment and the context in which you are. I mean, the political, the cultural context, to write things which are as close as possible from reality. But it will never be 100% reality because subjectivity will always be there. I think if we're talking about impacts, because all ministries of foreign affairs are still writing a lot. This is what I'm saying to my students who want to become diplomats. If you don't like writing reports, do another job, right? Because a great part of your work would be to collect information, make a synthesis, and then write reports to send it to the headquarters. I'm not sure that everything which is written is really read, right? And quite a lot of reports are not read. So a challenge for somebody who is posted, for diplomat who is posted abroad, is how to make sure that the headquarters read what I am sending. And here I think there are differences. When you are in a country with a strong cultural difference, probably your headquarters will read more carefully what you are sending, because it's not so easy for them to understand, right? It's not so easy for somebody based in Brazil to understand what is going on in China. And it's the same in a European country. When you are a German diplomat in Paris or a Brazilian diplomat in Argentina, probably in the headquarters, the people would consider that they know, because the country is closed, etc. And here would become more frustrating for you, especially also because now heads of state and government, Sherpas, advisors of presidents of the republic and a prime minister, they have their own contact. Let's take the Franco-German relation, for instance. It's a very good example. Most of the political issues which have to be dealt between the two countries are directly dealt by the presidency of the Republic in Paris and the chancellorship in Berlin. So if you are a French ambassador in Berlin, or if you're a German ambassador in Paris, your added values in terms of political inputs is relatively limited. What you are doing is mostly public diplomacy, right? If you are in a country where it's much more difficult understand and to decodify, then you have more, you have probably more chance to be read. But in general, I think diplomats have to ask the question, is it necessary to write so much, right? I think it's a question for all ministries of foreign affairs in the world.
Well, beside the sometimes the importance of the event, the importance of the situation that naturally draw the attention of others to read the papers, what do you think about the methods of collection and analysis of diplomatic information? In academy, in colleges and universities, you have a very solid and traditional methodology, scientific methodology to collect and analyze. How do you see the methods that are being used today in diplomacy? They are updated. Do you think that the kind of methods being used today, they reflect the necessity of our modern times, or we are still working like our predecessors in diplomacy were doing in the past decades or even centuries at the most?
Well, the way cables and reports are written, it's true, are not very different from what they were 30 years ago. Definitely. Uh-huh. But, what is important is where does the information come from? When you read, for instance, the cables of the U.S. Diplomacy, because we had this leak with WikiLeaks, etc., you could see that in the case of the U.S., for instance, it's very professional, even for somebody who is an academic, right? The way the problem is, first of all, summarized, the way we analyze the psychology of the actors, the agencies, and then the structures, etc., etc. But I think what is very important today is the diversification of your sources. For me, a bad report or a bad cable is something which is only based on, one or two informations coming from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in the country where you are based. This is the facility. Now, what you have to do is to see the social actors, you have to see representatives of the society, etc. And I think a good ambassador is somebody who said to the young people, I'm speaking about people who are posted, right? You don't have to stay in your office. You have to go outside the office, right? And you have to see people. You have to take coffees, make interviews, etc., and then write your report on the basis of those diverse sources of information. I think a good ambassador has to encourage the staff to, and I'm thinking about the chancery staff, of course, not to stay inside the embassy and to go abroad. But I know also that, and this is a general phenomenon, every Ministry of Foreign Affairs is confronted now more and more to procedures, to management, to bureaucratic task, you know, which blocks you inside your office, and there is a contradiction here. If you want to be well informed and write interesting things for the capitals, you don't have to be blocked in the embassy. You need to have the flexibility to go outside the embassy.
And when you are mentioning the necessity of written texts, in fact, when we consider, for instance, social medias, each social medium has a special language. For instance, the way to communicate in Facebook or Instagram or Twitter varies a lot. How do you see the due to the exposition that the diplomats have today? In some countries, at least, they are encouraged to use social medias. If I think that the British ambassadors, for instance, they are encouraged to have a Twitter channel to communicate very often. How do you consider, how do you see the question of this kind of media training as part of the diplomatic training? If you could elaborate a little bit more on this, please.
Well, I think it's crucial, but what is risky is when everybody is tweeting, you know what I mean, inside the embassy. You need some procedure, and this is why you mentioned the ambassadors. I think it's important that there is a reflection about who is tweeting, what are we tweeting. So it's important to have a form of hierarchy and a form of centralization in the departure of the information. This is why having the ambassadors doing that with a team, I mean the communication team, is probably the best way. We have to be cautious also that the ambassador is not tweeting without speaking to the colleagues, etc., right? Because you have always this temptation to answer very, very quickly and be in the debate, etc. No, it's using the social media in embassies has to become also a teamwork with procedure and form of hierarchy. If not, you take the risk of mistakes.
And I would like to approach this same subject from a different angle. In your opinion, why do some foreign ministries and diplomatic bodies not use their complete potential for social media to promote public diplomacy, engage the public, and positively influence international perception of their countries? What are the challenges? So before, in the question before, we spoke more about the role of the diplomat using social medias. Now I'd like to see with you your opinion about the approach of the ministries as a general in a kind of public diplomacy. I believe that in France we have this famous expression, a soft power, but I believe that in France we use the diplomatie d'influence, the influence of diplomacy. It's not soft power. It's not a literal translation of that. How do you see the question of public diplomacy led by the ministries of foreign affairs as a whole, in general?
First of all, I think there is a difference between soft power and public diplomacy, which is translated with diplomacy and influence in France. But in fact, diplomacy and influence is public diplomacy. What is the difference? The difference is that you can have influence and attractiveness without any volunteer public policy. Let's take higher education in the US, for instance. Higher education in the US, the US government doesn't have to mobilize to attract students, etc., because you have those Ivy League universities with very recognized famous research, etc. And this is soft power. Public diplomacy means that you have the intervention of the state to create a form of public policy to organize the influence. And it's true that it is not exactly the same from one country to another. Clearly, you have countries which have invested more in public diplomacy than others. But everybody now, I think, in diplomatic services is convinced that you cannot have an efficient diplomacy without public diplomacy. Those who were more reluctant were the countries traditionally based very much on hard power, right? To a certain extent, French was a bit in this tradition, even not so easy what I'm saying, because if you take the role of cultural diplomacy, Alliance Française, Lycée Français, etc., it's very old. But there was a sort of tradition inside the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs to concentrate a lot on political security issues, etc. But this time is over. This time is over, and I think everybody is convinced now that you need to have public diplomacy. What strikes me also is not just the democracies which needs public diplomacy. It's also the authoritarian states. They also develop public diplomacy, right? China has a public diplomacy, of course. And of course, it raised them the question, which is not an easy question for researchers and also for practitioners. Then what is the difference between public diplomacy and what we called in the past propaganda? Personally, I would say that there is a difference. There is a difference. In propaganda, you try to communicate on a very unilateral way and try to, push your argument and expect that everybody took it. In public diplomacy, you are expecting that your argument is creating a debate, etc., and that you could have a feedback also. So public diplomacy does not refuse controversy when propaganda totally refuses controversy.
In the United States Foreign Service, we have the public diplomacy as one of the tracks, of career tracks. But I'm not sure if in any other countries, I cannot remember. At this moment, if they have created a career path call it like this. I don't know in French in recent times.
No.
I don't think so.
No, it's very specific to the career in the United States of America. You have to choose when you take the exam, and you stay in one track, right? It could be public diplomacy, but it could also be economic diplomacy, could be consular affairs, etc. And it's just when you reach the level of ambassadors that this disappeared, because an ambassador is supposed to have an horizontal view on everything. I'm not sure this is the best system, because I see one disadvantage. Of course, the advantage is that you specialize, and let's take the people who are the public diplomacy officers. Of course, they can invest a lot in how to manage the new tools, the social media, etc., etc. But if you take the organization of the embassies, for instance, it also means that there are then a lot of silos, you know, and people are working in silos a bit. And I'm not sure at the end this is the right way, because you have also interaction all the time between the different activities. Let's take again the example of cultural diplomacy. It's clear that cultural diplomacy has a strong connection also with economic diplomacy, right? If you train people in your universities, in your high schools, etc., you also expect that those people one day they will invest in your country, they will make business with you, etc., etc. This is why I'm for such a job, I'm not against the idea, which is the old tradition of remaining a generalist. It's for me, it's providing more benefits and advantage than being too specialized.
One thing that I come to a conclusion is that even if we do not have a career path, call it a public diplomacy, public diplomacy is a very important and strategic topic today for any Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Do you agree?
Of course I do agree. Of course. And what it means using images about your country. And it's difficult, because if you want to make a good public diplomacy, you have to use sometimes clichés, because clichés can be useful, and also destroy clichés on the other time. Let me take the example of Brazil. When you speak about Brazil to an ordinary Frenchman, what will he see about Brazil? He will immediately see Rio de Janeiro, Copacabana, etc., the images of the nice beaches, tourism. This is what he will get in mind. For a Brazilian diplomat, well, this is something that has to be used, because having French tourists in Brazil is something positive for the economy of the country, etc. But on the other way, you have to destroy also the cliché that Brazil is only that. Right. You have also to make sure that you communicate on the fact that Brazil is also an industrial country with high technology, with very good universities, etc. So this is exactly what does not come first in the heads of ordinary people. So you see, it's a combination between using positively what I call clichés, and destroying on the other side cliché. It's not easy, but it's something that needs reflection and teamwork. And this is why in many countries now you have groups of diplomats, sometimes in specific agencies, who are working about what we call nation branding. How do you brand an image to make sure that it is as positive as possible for the country?
I was going straight to this point you mentioned, the point of nation branding. I believe that the image of countries is also a topic that is part of your studies today, the influence and study of the images of countries and institutions. Do you see public diplomacy and nation branding as concepts that are very near one of another? Do you believe that they are different things, or they have much more in common than more things makes them close to each other than separates them?
No, I think it's going together, because if you establish nation branding, it means that you have reflected about what you will use as images to make your public diplomacy. And again, you have to use very traditional image, close from cliché sometimes. For the French, the food, the baguette, etc., and the other way, you have to destroy the cliché to make the reality of the economy, of the technology, etc., understandable by the rest of the world. So if you are establishing a nation brand, you have to reflect on that, and then it's useful for doing your public diplomacy.
You see that as part of a state strategic planning, a kind of strategic planning that should be part of the planning of ministries of foreign affairs, or do you see it as a more spontaneous movement in order to try to develop this concept of nation branding and the concept of public diplomacy? How do you think there is a coordinated effort to put forward these two concepts?
No, it's totally strategic, and strategy means that you need sometimes to reflect, and that you don't have to take only the time being, but you have to project also in the future. So this is why it's important to have inside ministries of foreign affairs places where you can do a bit of strategy, because most of the people will not have time to make strategy. They will have just to react to what is going on an everyday basis. But planning staff, strategic unit, etc., this is very useful inside ministries of foreign affairs, and more because of public diplomacy. And I know that in many ministries of foreign affairs, we consider that the strategic units, you know, of course, they are nice, they are a bit the academics of the minister, but this is not where the real work is doing, etc. It's totally misleading. It's a mistake. Now, more and more inside the ministries of foreign affairs, you will need also to have part of your staff, and probably also connected with the outside world, academics, businessmen, etc., who takes the time to reflect about the image of the country, also the policies of the country, and try to project them a bit in the future. So strategies is, I think, very important still.
As we conclude today's enriching dialogue, it's clear that the realm of diplomacy and international relations is ever evolving with a myriad of complex facets. I would like to thank Professor Christian Lequen for joining our podcast with his profound knowledge and experience. And I highly recommend delving deeper into topics discussed today by exploring scholarly articles and engaging in discussions to broaden your understanding. Professor, I would like to pass you again the floor for your final remarks, please.
Well, thank you very much for this very productive conversation, and I know that you are coming from the Foreign Service yourself. You are an ambassador, even if you're working for the moment for a think tank. But precisely the kind of conversation we had, so trying to exchange about diplomacy between diplomats and academics, it is what we need. This is what we need, and both sides need it, because necessarily, according to where you speak from, you don't see the things exactly in the same way, right? And if you want to progress, it's a bit like in understanding the other culture. You have to understand how the other also is thinking, right? And take argument from the others. This is why it's not necessarily true in Brazil, because I know that in Brazil, interactions between university and Ministry of Foreign Affairs have a long tradition, but in some other countries it was not the case. University was relatively separated from the diplomatic services, and this is not productive. So congratulations for organizing this kind of exchanges, because this is exactly what we need.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Professor. As we draw to a close on this enlightening episode of Diplomacy 21, I invite you to stay tuned for our upcoming episodes, where we'll continue to unravel the complexities and nuances of diplomacy in the 21st century. Thank you once again, and see you in the next episode.
Thank you.